Hi, everyone. This is Brian Kilmeade. You may know me from Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends and more, and the Brian Kilmeade Radio Show. Now I'm excited to share my new book, The President and the Freedom Fighter, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and their battle to save America's soul. It's about the little-known story of how two American heroes and patriots disagreed, united, and changed the course of history and made America free for all. It's available now wherever books are sold.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Bleak House by Charles Dickens. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Dwight Lindley, a professor of English at Hillsdale College. He has podcasted with us previously on Middlemarch and Moby Dick and Paradise Lost, as well as A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. He joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Dwight, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Great to be here once again, John. Thanks.
Why is Bleak House by Charles Dickens a great book?
Well, this is one of the greatest novels by one of the greatest novelists. That's a first thing. Second thing is, this is a novel for the modern world. It's a novel about things that are still very much present to us and that we care about, such as the mess of bureaucracy and law that still swallows us up. And how do we find our place in a big world where our little lives don't seem to matter? There are a bunch of big existential but also political and social questions that I think it really gives a captivating vision of and provides, you know, I don't want to say simple solutions, but really thoughtful and meaningful meditations on.
We're going to talk about all that. We're going to talk about what this novel says about the legal system and bureaucracy and families and characters and so much more. But Dwight, let's start with the first chapter of Bleak House. In the first chapter of this novel, we learn about a court case called Jarndyce and Jarndyce. And Dickens writes in that first chapter, quote, "Jarndyce and Jarndyce drones on. This scarecrow of a suit has, in course of time, become so complicated that no man alive knows what it means," unquote. So, Dwight, what is this case, and how does it loom over the novel?
And how is it different than the way we make laws today?
Right.
But never mind. Jarndyce and Jarndyce is indeed the court case that structures the whole novel. There are all of these people. Most of the characters in the novel are wrapped up in it in one way or another. And it's emblematic of a lot of the bureaucratic and structural problems that Dickens thought he saw in his world, in the modern world, where we are all moving into the city, the 19th century, Victorian period, great time for urbanization and centralization and industrialization. Everybody's moving to the city to get jobs. And so how do we find our place there? Jarndyce and Jarndyce is an image of this social and legal and political system that's straining to deal with all these people, but really losing them. And Dickens thought this was one of the great challenges of the modern world. And it's a kind of image of the decadence to which human culture just naturally tends when it's left on its own. It has to be reformed. But there's also a suggestion it may not ever be fully reformed. You know, this may not be a solvable problem. So, long answer short, Jarndyce and Jarndyce is an image of the problems of his age. But it's also an image of the problems of the human situation in a messed up world where we all have our own challenges to deal with. And so it symbolizes a lot.
It's an inheritance case. It involves conflicting wills. And it's this interminable legal proceeding.
That's right.
And this has a satiric kind of dimension then.
It is. The picture that he gives of the courtroom in which this is being adjudicated, the Chancery Court, so-called.
And what is the Court of Chancery?
The Court of Chancery just dealt with these inheritance questions, which were all continually being adjudicated in a culture that where so much based on land inheritance and you know, coming out of the older world into the more mobile modern world, which is less land based. But this is a holdover from this older system. So it's chiefly real estate law and inheritance law.
But he's lampooning the whole legal system.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he thought it was just an old encrusted relic of a bygone era that no longer fit the way we live our lives.
And as you say, it touches the lives of so many of the characters in Bleak House. And we're going to talk about some of those characters in a moment. But it also destroys lives.
That's
doesn't
right.
It? To use what's maybe an anachronism, there's a Kafka-esque quality to Jarndyce and Jarndyce. There's a nightmarish, irrational kind of quality to it, and it really hurts a lot of people.
That's right. People become obsessed with it the way they become obsessed with lotteries today and with our own large-scale social networks that we have where you can get ensnared in all these ways, and your life gets tied up within your hopes and your imagination and your dreams. And you can never get out of it, and people become depressed, and actually there are more than one suicide in this novel from this case that people have all of their hopes and dreams pinned up in. One of the main characters is a fellow named Richard Carstone, who dies at the end because he's been essentially worn down and emaciated by this case, and it ruins his life.
Let's move into discussing some of the characters of Bleak House now. Esther Summerson.
Mm.
She's the heroine of the book. Who is she?
Esther Summerson is, first of all, one of the two narrators of the book. The opening narrator is a kind of satirical, streetwise London narrator with a sharp tongue. And then the other one is...
But that's not a character except as a sort of an omniscient kind of voice.
That's right. Never mentioned. He's just an omniscient voice and has a very distinct voice from the other narrator, who is Esther Summerson, who narrates her half of the book. Every few chapters, they'll switch off. And she's just a sweet, you know, demure young woman who tends to think the best about people and to think the worst about herself. And she's an orphan who gets taken in by a kindly older man and eventually given a home in his house. And she's the main character.
And the kindly older man is John Jarndyce.
Is John Jarndyce.
Who is obviously connected to the Jarndyce and Jarndyce legal case.
He is. He's caught up in the same case, but has really defined himself against it and has decided not to care about it. He's really artificially, carefully distanced himself from it because he thinks it's toxic, as in fact it is. So he's one of the images of how you should relate to this court case, which is to say, distance yourself from it, don't catch your hopes up in it, do your own thing elsewhere.
And he's just a really decent person.
He's a great guy.
There are some bad people in this novel.
There are all kinds.
But John Jarndyce is a really stand-up guy.
That's right. He takes care of widows and orphans, you know, like the good book says. And he actually, at the book begins with three different orphans coming to stay with him, who are all implicated in this case in one way or another. He feels sorry for them, decides he's going to do them a good turn, and then they all fall in together and the story unfolds, each of them. One of those is Esther Summerson.
And she's a companion to a woman called Ada Clare. Who is Ada Clare, and what does it mean to be a companion to somebody?
I suppose this is one of those real 19th century notes here, but Ada is... Well, Ada is maybe a slightly more well-born figure who is also, nevertheless, an orphan. And, well, you know, women of means would frequently have a companion there who would not be exactly a maid, but somewhere between a maid and a friend, really closer to a friend, but... You know, a little one step down the pecking order,
but a hired friend. It's a peculiar arrangement.
That's right. I don't know if they're paying her exactly, unless you count room and board and a place in the family as paying. it is an arrangement, let's say, that is in both of their interests. And yeah, there are all kinds of relationships like this that we don't really have as much anymore.
Character I want to mention now is Lady Deadlock, one of these great Dickensian names, right? Deadlock.
Deadlock.
We learn about her pretty early in the novel. Important character. Who is Lady Deadlock?
Lady Deadlock is the center of the life of fashion and wealth moving through the novel, and she has her country seat out it's called Chesney Wold, which is a big mansion house and park out in the country, and then she has her place in town, and people are just following her around because she's rich and famous and beautiful, but she's sort of tortured and seems to be running from something. She has a restlessness about her, and you know, it comes on you gradually that she's really missing a child. She doesn't have a child. She's never been able to have one. And there's this palpable longing that she has. We could talk about where that goes.
Well, we maybe don't want to do too many spoilers here, but there's definitely a sense of mystery that hangs about
Certainly.
Her. And there's this early scene when she's reviewing a legal document, as characters in Bleak House and connected to Jarndyce and Jarndyce are wont to do. She's reviewing a legal document. She seems to recognize the handwriting in it.
That's right. She's being shown this by the family lawyer, Tulkinghorn, who's sort of a dark, I mean, rather sinister figure. And she recognizes the handwriting, and this starts off one plot strand in this novel of many plot strands, which is her thinking about this man with his handwriting, whom she recognizes. And there's some connection to him from the past. And so she gradually seeks him out, finds his grave, and starts to visit his grave. And that ends up being that mystery of who that is and what that history is ends up becoming one.
That's a really important turning point.
That's right.
In the book. And this is a complicated book in certain ways. It has plots and subplots and lots of characters to keep track of. And I think as you read it, it's not so hard, but it can be difficult to summarize all
I think
these
that's one of the daunting things about the book, besides being almost 1,000 pages. It's just an entire world. It really is trying to give you an entire world, largely in London, but also in the peripheries. And with all of these characters, a whole city of characters who we all care about eventually, but, you know, at the start, it's quite an investment to really give yourself to this book. Most of my students and friends and family who have read it, because I've gotten a lot of people to read this over the years, have said, you know, it takes 100, 200 pages in to really get invested. But when you do, it just carries you off for hundreds of pages and you can't let go of it.
I had to read it in college for a course on the modern novel. Mm. This was a fall semester. And the professor said to us in the spring, he said, come to class having read it. Mm. In other words, read it in August. Don't start it in September.
That's great advice.
Yeah, you have 1 week, and it's impossible. We also did this with Middlemarch, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we had homework before the course started. But come to class having read both these things, because they're so both so long and absorbing, and you can do it at a more relaxed pace when you're not deserving whatever.
I mean, the funny thing is, I still do that today, John. I mean, I always email the students ahead of time and say, please read this before you come to class. Because otherwise you're going to get crushed.
Yeah, too bad.
It's going to be 200 to 300 pages per class for a few days.
This is the way to do it, is to let yourself to enter its world and mm-hmm. experience it at a pace where you can really appreciate and understand
and
love.
Right. That's right, because it's, in the 19th century, this may be something you want to talk about. This novel was coming out in pieces, and these would be published every couple months. And people would just all sit down together in the drawing room and read it out loud. That's the way it was made to be an immersive experience for everyone.
it's kind of like what people did before streaming television, right? You'd gather around and read Dickens, and the shows would come out in these serial installments, and that leads to another question: is how did Dickens compose? Did he write the whole thing and then it came out in serial form, or was he writing all the way and meeting deadlines? And how does this affect story and composition?
That's a great question and an interesting one. He generally conceived of the novel ahead of time, thought of a lot of the places he was going to go with it. I should say this is how he did it with his later novels. His first novel or two, he just started writing and just discovered where it went. And you can really feel that in the Pickwick Papers, which is his first novel. But by the time he's writing this, mid-career, he's planning out the whole novel, but then writing it for each month or bi-monthly release date. And so he's got the general arc, but he hasn't planned out the dialogue. He hasn't even planned out all the twists. And, you know, the book does surprise him sometimes. He's the kind of writer that will let it go where it wants to go somewhat. One little entertaining vignette that I think your listeners would enjoy is the way that he would write famously was out loud. One of his children recounts getting to sit in her father's study one time when he's composing a novel. And he's sitting there, she said, talking to himself in the voices of his characters. And then he will respond to those voices with the voices of other characters. He had them all inside of himself in some sense, and he was getting to know them over the course of the novel.
Did he edit between the serial publication and when the book came out in novel form? Bleak House, he was serializing in 1852 and 1853. Then it came out as a book in 1853. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of time between the two, but did he revise?
Sure. He made some revisions. Not a terrible number, but you can see, you can see some differences.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and I want to tell you about National Review Plus. With NR Plus, you get unlimited access to National Review's digital magazine. That means no paywall, all the issues in our online archive, and all the podcasts. But this is more than a digital subscription. It's a membership that includes access to our members-only Facebook page, members-only conference calls with NR writers, editors, and guests, members-only commenting on the site, and a lot fewer ads, including none with an article. So to learn more, please go to nationalreview.com/PLUS. We've already discussed Esther Summerson, this part-time narrator, John Jarndyce, Lady Dedlock, Ada Clare. You mentioned Richard Carstone. There's another character who has a great scene, a melodramatic scene, a famous scene in not just Bleak House, but really all of Victorian literature, you might say, and that's Joe. Who is Joe, and what is this famous scene?
Midway through the novel, really something like two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the novel, this young boy dies. We've gotten invested in his story gradually over the course of the drama, but his name is just J-O, no E at the end. It's sort of a symbol of his illiteracy because he's a street orphan with no knowledge of his parents. And really, you know, like I said, illiteracy, but almost no understanding of hardly anything. Other than he knows a few people, and he knows about a few things. So he's a pathetic figure, pathetic not in a bad sense, but he draws out pathos, right, from the reader. And he's weaving his way through the novel. He's an image, if you want, of the way that the lowest class of people in Dickens's world had been left behind unintentionally, but very sadly, by the culture in which they lived. And Dickens's goal, one of his goals in writing, was to bring these kinds of people into the public vision. I would just say the famous chapter with him is his death, where he's actually finally surrounded by people who care about him, and he's led sort of painfully and really only halfway through the Lord's Prayer by a friendly doctor who was there. And it's an image, I would say, at the heart of the novel. It was very famous because it was melodramatic. You know, it was really a tearjerker. But it's at the heart of this novel because he is a sufferer who eventually finds meaning through the love of those around him and makes his way into the next life. And there are indications that this is really the path that everybody's on. Most people can just buffer themselves from the fact that they need love and they need meaning and that they need a path through to heaven. Most people can keep that more distant from themselves, but he is forced to find it and to face it and makes it present to everybody else.
A character, a minor character, whom I remember vividly from having read this book so long ago, 30 years ago, is Mrs. Jellybee. who is she, and what makes her noteworthy?
Sure, she is a philanthropist and a bad mother. She is just utterly abstracted from her many children who are falling all over her house and leaving it in rubble and one another in pieces, while she's at the desk working on these charity cases overseas. But in this African colony called Borio Bulaga, which is a made-up place. The interesting thing about her and the angle that Dickens is taking with her in the novel is she's almost an image of the way that we can get caught up in these abstractions, these abstract do-gooding causes that take us other places where we can look at problems elsewhere that are far from us, because it's more comfortable to do that than to look at the people right around you, like your kids, for example, but also the poor people who live on your street and who pass you by in the street. She's utterly abstracted, and this is one of the things that the novel's really interested in, is the way that we can really distance ourselves from the problems right in front of us and the needs right in front of us, because that's more comfortable. You get the thrill of taking care of people, but without all the difficulties.
And one of the themes of the book is family life and what is proper and good family life. And we see these orphans, and we see these families that are just kind of assembled not through blood relations but caring about each other. We also see uncaring families. We see broken families. All of that. What is Charles Dickens trying to tell us about families?
That's a good question. They're orphans just littering the novel. Many of the main characters are orphans, or they are parents seeking children. They're broken families, just really at the heart of it, as you already said. So what is he saying about that? Well, one big macro thought is just that I think he thinks all humans are more like orphans than they realize. That we're all, in certain senses, orphans, and that we're alienated from our place and our family in the modern world. This is a world where we don't live where our parents lived anymore. Even if we have still living parents, we're in a way orphaned because we live far from them. This is a very new thing in the 19th century with urbanization and industrialization and travel. But also, of course, in a very much broader sense, Dickens would say all human beings have this kind of restlessness that they're not where they belong, right? That there's something, we're never quite happy. We're always dissatisfied. Okay, so he's thinking about all of this by making orphans central. And as you said, what is the solution to this? It's just figuring out how to take care of each other amidst all of the brokenness and cobbling together the families these makeshift families that where you give yourself to each other and take care of each other however you can. That is actually the meaning of human life, I think, that this novel presents us with is you may be far away from where you want to be. You may not be where you thought you would be. You may be missing the main people in your life, but there are people right around you who are the opportunity that you have to do the right thing and to really make a meaningful life together.
There's a great line from Mother Teresa, Saint Mother Teresa, that says something like, if you want to change the world, start by loving your family.
That's right. Just do it right there. And that's a very Bleak House thought. Can I just say one last thing about that? It's just the title of this novel is Bleak House, which is the place where Esther Summerson lives with John Jarndyce out in the country. And this is one of the things that turns people off from the novel, perhaps.
It sounds so depressing.
Yeah, they see it and they're like, oh, this is just going to be a downer. But it's actually a very happy place. And the point is, everybody lives in a bleak house, which means everybody lives in a world with suffering, where everything is not as it should be, where we're all a little more orphaned than we want to be, etc. What are you going to do about it, is the question of the novel. Some people take the bleak house, the sufferings of life, and make it worse. They complain, etc. And other people actually push into it, ask, what can I do? Who are the people that have been given to me to take care of, to really make a little community, a little platoon out of?
Another character I got to ask about is called Crook. And it's Crook with a K, K-R-O-O-K. He's a rag and bottle merchant. And what interests me about this guy, of course, is what happens to him. He dies of spontaneous combustion. And it's not like a Scooby-Doo episode where there's a revelation later that he didn't actually die of spontaneous combustion with something else. No, he actually dies of spontaneous
combustion.
That's
right. That's right. No, you got to take this seriously, or else you'll never understand the end of the movie Spinal Tap. No, but
this is the bizarre gardening accident,
right,
of Bleak House.
Right. That's right. But seriously, this was something that Dickens took a lot of heat for in his own time, that this fellow Crook, so aptly named, a sort of dark fellow who collects all of the objects that used to belong to dead people, and all these papers and all kinds of trash, what we would call a secondhand store. Well, he dies by spontaneous combustion in the middle. And what is happening there? Two things. One, Dickens, in the face of all of his critics who said, this is utterly unrealistic, people don't die by spontaneous combustion, Dickens always responded with, well, there are some studies, there are some people who have said this happens sometimes. And he would cite them chapter and verse. Look, people talk about it. But on the other hand, the real reason that he has it there is as a symbol of the implosion of this broken system that is connected to chancery. This man, Crook, likes to call himself the Lord Chancellor, who is the real Lord Chancellor is the judge that's in charge of chancery. But this fellow Crook, who just owns, an illiterate, who owns this dirty shop with all these people's stuff in it, a pawnbroker, essentially, of a certain kind, he says, I'm the Lord Chancellor. So he's kind of a symbol of this broken system which implodes spontaneously and leaves a disgusting mess behind. That's it's an almost allegorical moment for the meaning of this book.
One more character who's of special interest to me because I'm a fan of crime fiction and detective fiction, is Inspector Bucket, who is one of the very first detectives to appear in literature.
That's right. That's right. Perhaps only Poe before this?
Poe gets credit with the first detective story, the first detective in fiction, and Murders in the Rue Morgue, a short story.
That's right. So Mr. Bucket comes in halfway through the novel, and he's hired by various figures who are trying to learn about other figures and are trying to actually discover what's going on in their lives and what's the real story. Famously, he ends up pursuing Lady Dedlock through several chapters in about two-thirds of the way through, and I won't go into all of that so we can leave some plot intact for people to discover. But what is he doing here? He is this... he's a very positive figure for Dickens, who is interested in the way that Bucket can read people and get a sense for where things are likely to go. He, in a way, is the kind of the image of the novelist here, that he's trying to put the story together about each person and see who are you and what are you likely to do and which way are you going and how are you going to handle this. He's reading people and discerning the truth about them and following them out. That's Dickens's ideal investigator, crime scene investigator here, which I think is a stand-in for him in a certain sense. He's a very kind of funny, friendly, charitable man, but with a kind of a real sharp eye.
Dwight, this is the fourth work by Dickens I've done in this podcast series. We did, you and I did, A Christmas Carol many moons ago. Also, we've done David Copperfield, and we've done A Tale of Two Cities. A lot of scholars and critics and admirers of Dickens say Bleak House is his very best book. What do you think?
Good question. I think it's a toss-up between Bleak House and David Copperfield. I think David Copperfield is a fuller development of a single character. And so there's a kind of superiority there. There's a sort of unity to David Copperfield that you don't have in Bleak House. But Bleak House is, I think, more carefully wrought as a novel. The plot, rather the interweaving plot strands and their resolutions, are just magnificently, orchestrally drawn together in a way that we don't quite have with David Copperfield. But I think those are the two at the top of the heap. And I say that as a lover of multiple, many Dickens novels. So I think that it really does. This is one of the two or three best novels of the whole century in English.
How did you discover Dickens as a reader and then come to want to teach him at the college level?
Sure. I think I read, well, I read a couple in high school. I read Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations, like a lot of high schoolers do. And then I read this one, Bleak House, in college. And I think David Copperfield in college. And then studied him further later. But he's really taken... He's really come back into my life, quite frankly, John, through The Christmas Carol, which I first thought was, well, a more superficial, chintzy piece. But the older I've gotten, the deeper it's gotten, A Christmas Carol. And so rediscovering it in my 30s, I thought, wow, Dickens is deeper than I gave him credit for. This is not just, you know, empty entertainment. And so A Christmas Carol brought me back to the longer novels. And now, I mean, he's really at the forefront of my teaching. And he's really one of my maybe two favorite novelists now.
Who's the other?
Virginia Woolf is actually the other favorite right now. Maybe Evelyn Waugh is the third.
I thought you were going to say George Eliot.
George Eliot was my first love. But Dickens has really stolen the spotlight from her recently.
One more question as we wrap up. What is the case for reading Bleak House now, 170 years or so after it was first published? Is there a reason to read it in the 21st century?
The themes are still our themes. It's looking for love and meaning in a complex modern world where we're continually tempted to solve our problems by abstract bureaucratic means. That's still a challenge and a struggle today, and this novel really speaks directly to that. And so I think this is still very much a novel for us today.
If you've ever made a phone call to try and solve your hospital bill, you should learn about Jarndyce and Jarndyce.
That's right. That's right. and just the bureaucracy of the government. This is not the same thing as the modern administrative state, but the bureaucracy that it describes has the same problems that ours does.
Dwight Lindley, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
My pleasure, John. Thanks for having me on again.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.